Hi, this is Joe Canale, and you're listening to Improv Nerd with Jimmy Corain.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, sponsored by, guess what, my award-winning improv classes here in Chicago, The Art of Slow Comedy, where we teach you, before you can be funny, you need to be real, and guess what, you're even funnier. Starting April 15th, we will have an Art of Slow Comedy Level 3 class. It's called Advanced Ensemble, where we teach you long forms that support the Art of Slow Comedy method. There will be a performance at the end of class. It's at Green Shirt Studio here in Chicago. For more information, go to jimmycorain.com. All classes are limited to 12. Then, if you're in Chicago in the summer, I will be offering the Art of Slow Comedy Summer Intensives, July 11th and 12th, and then we'll offer another one on July 25th and 26th. For more information about the summer intensives, just go to jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. Oh, brother, do we have a show for you today? Our guest today is the one and only former Second City main stager and I.O. Chicago and now I.O. West performer. He's a great improviser and teacher as well. I'm talking about Joe Canale. We talked to Joe about why he's so comfortable being the lightning rod, always taking on authority, why hosting the improv jam when he was starting out at I.O. was so beneficial to him, and why he feels he left Boom Chicago and the Second City main stage too soon. I'm really glad that we got Joe as a guest and that this show worked out, because when we started this show, Improv Nerd, just so you know what show I'm talking about 3 years ago, Joe was on the top of our list, and I reached out to Joe. I've known Joe for a fair amount of time here in Chicago. Huge respect for him. We did a show at the Second City ETC in the Unhinged series. I always enjoyed working with him. So I reached out to him and asked him if he'd be a guest. He agreed to do it, and then at the last minute, he canceled on me. And I was hurt by that. I felt really angry by that. And, of course, I harbored a huge resentment for a long time. And then Joe's reached out a couple times to say he wanted to do the show, and he was coming into Chicago from Los Angeles, which he does because he has a daughter here. And so I decided to get over the resentment and have him on the show. And just so you know, it's my stuff I'm talking about. But before I had him on the show, I emailed him and I said, it was more of a Facebook message, just saying, you know, I was really angry and hurt that you canceled the last time. And, you know, it was very important for me to tell him how I was feeling about that. So I didn't hold on to it when I did the interview. So at the top of this episode, which you're going to hear, I'm telling you in about 10 seconds, we talk about that exchange, that resentment that I was holding on to. So I'm really glad it worked out because I love Joe. I love working with him. And he is so honest in this interview, and he has so much great stuff to say about his career and improv. And here it is, the Joe Canale episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah.
I'm so glad this worked out, because we had a couple times where we tried to, and then it didn't work out, and then I had a resentment. And
you know, it's so great. You sent me, I don't know if it was Facebook or email or whatever, but yeah, I had been scheduled to come on a while ago, and we were talking about it over there. And when I come into town, it's usually, I come into town to see my daughter, and so it's usually just a quick weekend, and I didn't realize how early the show was then. And I bailed probably with not enough notice. I apologize. It's something I would hate if it happened to me. And then anyway, you wrote back when we were scheduling this one, and you wrote, you know, last time you canceled, and I was resentful, and I felt angry, and I was very emotional about it. And that's like the best Facebook message I've ever gotten.
How did you take that?
I chuckled. I laughed. Because okay. I know you, and you're like you're an open neurotic, and
right.
So that's
well, and I feel like, with our relationship, even though we haven't worked tremendous, we always could be honest with each other.
Exactly.
Because I remember a time we were back. I'm not going to say where the theater was, but
sure.
Can we talk about your getting high and smoking pot?
I think we're doing it right now.
Okay.
I think by asking the question in that way, it guarantees we're talking
about
it.
So we were doing a show, and you pulled out a one-hitter.
This is years ago. Maybe a year ago. Who knows?
No, this is years ago. And I just go, Joe, please, could you put that away? We're having notes. And you're like, oh, you just put it away. And I always felt like we could be honest with each
other. Sure. That's a very reasonable request. I'm surprised that I took that out in such brazen, you know, marijuana is not illegal in this state.
No.
It's not legal.
But here's the thing that I like about you. You are someone who doesn't like authority. Mm. So it doesn't surprise me.
I do not. I was thinking about that watching the other interview.
Okay.
Dana was very nice with some of her answers, and I was like, no.
But and you can be a smartass, too, to authority.
I almost, as a rule,
right.
To my detriment.
Right, because I've seen how you've handled Sharna and,
yes.
You know.
If you consider her an authority, I mean.
So how did this all start, this kind of like poking fun of authority?
I'm sure way back. I'm sure when I was a little kid. And like with Sharna, this is something I've discussed many times with therapists.
You're in therapy?
In and out, you know. Okay. Every good improviser should be. I was kind of thinking about my general relationships with women, specifically in general, and I guess authority figures in a greater sense, but it all stems back to the way I associate with women and the things I enjoy with women. It harkens back to when I was, you know, maybe 10, 11, and I would enrage my mother in some way, who's Irish, traditional, probably a generation behind in her treatment of, you know, didn't mind hitting.
She hit you?
Oh yeah, but like totally deserved it. I don't like, I would drive her mad, and our living room went to the laundry room, went to the kitchen, went to the dining room in a circle. She would literally chase me for 5-6 minutes. She would not be able to catch me. And then she would pounce on me later on when I forgot.
Well, what do you mean pounce? Like physically throw her body on you?
Yeah, like. Did you ever see any of the Pink Panther movies when Kato would attack Inspector Clouseau? So Clouseau's just like there, and then all of a sudden Kato comes out, and he's like, aah! And my mother would like scream and like. This makes it sound like I was abused. I wasn't at all.
Okay.
But anyway, I enjoyed making her angry to the point that she wanted to hit me. But so I think that is the basis of my relationship with every woman I've ever met.
Because there was a part of me that, when I would watch this,
yeah.
That you there was a joy you took in with getting Sharna upset.
Yes. Well, I think right. As you describe and what I just said fits perfectly well together. Yeah. And just generally authority figures, you know, I can have respect for anyone, but I feel it, you know, your title doesn't get you your respect. I will learn to respect you based on your actions, not based on your title.
But there's also a part of you too that it IO, and certainly at Second City, where you are kind of a lightning rod.
Sure. I maybe define what you're saying.
I'm thinking about with main stage, and you always very vocal about they're not getting paid enough.
Yes.
And actually, you did. Can you tell us?
I take great pride in being the equity deputy of the main drain when I was there.
Now, why do you refer to it as the main drain?
I think Matt Craig maybe said that. I'm sure people over the years have said it. Just main drain.
It drains you?
No.
Okay.
It's just a way to insult it without really needing to, but just...
Right.
I love being on the main drain, but I call it the main drain.
But
there's no... Maybe other people who coined the phrase had a meaning to it. I guess it does drain you, but that's not why I did it.
But when you were there, you were very... You felt they weren't getting compensated for rehearsal time.
Yeah, there was a number... You know, I'm sure I don't follow it exactly, although... People still will email or text me by being a lightning rod. And I don't do this as much anymore. But if Sharna sends out a big group email, I am not on that email. We're not Facebook friends. We've had some social media interactions that have guaranteed we're not Facebook friends. Just good ribbing, good fun on my part. Just to digress, she let me stay at her house once. This is the worst thing. But she's always talking about all the pranks she did to me, so fuck it. I'll say it. Sharna let me stay at her house one time when I was in town. She was upstairs taking a shower or a steam or whatever she does. And I was downstairs, and her internet was up, and her Facebook page was up. And now, for example, like on the main stage, we would, if someone's Facebook page was up, that was fair game. You would play a joke on them. You would write something. People would usually write sincere, nice things on my page to fuck with the person. So I just wrote on Sharna's Facebook page, "Hey, everybody, I'm giving up the business and leaving the IO Theater to Bob Callahan." Okay? Now, Bob Callahan, he's a friend of mine. He's someone she knows. He's not someone who she would leave the theater to at all. He's an idiot. It'd be like leaving it to me. It would be as ridiculous as that. And I put it up there, and I am not kidding. 12 seconds, maybe. Her phone started vibrating behind me in the kitchen and did not stop until she came downstairs about 15 minutes later. Now, I deleted the post immediately. Once it started vibrating, I swear this thing wasn't up for more than 2 or 3 minutes at the most, because I do it and it's like, and then maybe look, and like there's like 12 comments immediately. What are you talking about? And I, are you kidding me? This is fucking Facebook. But she takes Facebook seriously, and so does everyone who's her Facebook friend. So she comes downstairs and she's like, "What's going on?" And she looks at her phone and she's like, "What's happening? I didn't say that." And she looks at him there in her kitchen and she puts that together. She's like, "What did you fucking do?"
And what did you say?
I said, "Listen, calm down." I took it down. I said that probably first. And she's like, "Why did you do it?" I was like, "Sharna, it was up for like a minute, you know." I told her and she yelled at me, and you know, she does this nice thing and lets me stay at her house, and I reward her by...
Did you apologize to her?
No. Because really, I have a thing with apologies. Okay. I will not apologize. You will not... If you get an apology from me, I mean it. Mm-hmm. And this has been a big point of contention throughout my years. I won't apologize if I don't feel... And usually, eventually, I'll kind of talk myself... I'll talk myself through it, and then I'll give an apology when I've considered the facts enough and I realize but I don't rush to judgment with apologies, and there are some people who don't get them when they expect them.
So you're in college. You went to...
Not now, but yes.
No, you did, yes.
It's a convention of the interview.
Right, SUNY Albany.
Yes.
Okay.
Just made the NCAA tourney.
Congratulations.
Third time in a row.
Congratulations.
Last second shot.
You had the nickname Weaselicious there.
Yes.
How did that come about?
I had a roommate, and I was I knew him from freshman year, and the two of us were like replacement fill-ins for two guys who dropped out of school in like a six-person suite. Like there were six people. They had their rooming all together. Two of them dropped out of school, so they added us. So me and this guy were staying together. And then you know how RAs put your name up on the door or whatever. And they put his name up on the door. And for some reason, his name was Brian, and I took Ryan down. I just had B up there. And I was like, "We're going to call you B from now on." And he got real mad. And he said, "Give me the..." And he wanted the letters to his name. He's like, "Give me those Weaselicious." And then he just called me that for a while.
And when you were at SUNY Albany, mm-hmm. is the first time you got exposed to improv?
Yes, a little bit, yes. I became a theater major when I was at school. By the way, the success in basketball at SUNY Albany is due in part to the fact that they gutted the arts program to build a new athletic center. So
why did
good
you go
job,
to,
SUNY.
Why did you were?
They don't have a theater degree anymore. My degree that I have does not exist at that school anymore.
But you really didn't do many shows there, right?
I'm like Michael J. Fox. I'm fading away.
Right.
No, I didn't do many shows. I did. I was involved in the shows, but it was a comprehensive program, so I didn't do too much acting. I had a very recreational college experience.
Why did you decide? Because you really were geared towards engineering, because you tested really well. Why theater?
The engineering thing is I applied to a lot of engineering schools and I got into some. But then my dad said, "You can go to the state school, I'll pay for the whole thing, and I'll buy you a car, or you can go to these private engineering schools and take out a bunch of loans." And I was like, fuck that. I do not like engineering anymore. So I was there, took all the intro classes, took a theater class, And then I was probably high when I took the theater class, and I liked it. And there probably was some component of trying to meet women, I would guess. Now that I think about it, that probably had to do with it. You know, pretty girls, actresses.
And then the improv experience there was very minimal, right?
Yeah, it was just like people doing it in living rooms who had found out about improv. And there was a guy named Aaron Haber who moved to Chicago. He was at that school as well. And some friends of mine and him, we would do it a little bit. I didn't do it that much, but I had a roommate in college, or a guy who was in the theater department who was moving to Chicago, and said, hey, you should go to Second City. And he may have just needed a roommate in Chicago, and so he said that. I didn't know him all that well, but I guess he knew me a little. I had been in plays that he had directed, and he kind of knew I was a wise ass, and he knew about Second City, so.
So you move here, and then you audition for the Second City Conservatory, and you get in.
Yeah, like a week after I got here. I got, like, a permanent job, and I got into the classes there, which, let's face it, getting into the conservatory, you got a pretty good shot of getting into the conservatory. And if you don't, we've got a class that will get you into the conservatory. All these, it's a big racket, all these classes.
And then you're taking classes at I.O.?
A little bit after that, I found out about I.O., so I was taking them both at the same time.
And then you become kind of a groupie, you know, hanging out after Armando.
Oh, yes.
And cornering people after the shows. What were you trying to get out of people?
That
was a great, the original cast, right?
Yeah, pretty much the first group of people who were doing it. Yeah, like Brian McCann is somebody who I thought was hysterical, and I'd kind of just sit gape-faced and look at him. And then, of course, Susan Messing and Amy Poehler were a couple of pot-smoking women who I would... who I probably had big crushes on both of them.
Did you use, like, hey, let's get high?
I may have married one of them.
Okay. Did you use, hey, let's get high together?
Absolutely. Okay. Weed has always been a great friend in relations with women.
So
I'm not saying I drug anyone.
So that's great.
Okay. I'm saying stoner women are easy, right, is what I'm saying. Okay. That's what I want to say.
So what when you would, like, talk to Brian McCann or Amy Poehler or Susan, what were you trying to just be friends with them?
Well, yeah, and be like, oh, you were so funny. That was so funny. I actually remember a move that Matt Besser did in a show where it had something to do with a fishing pole, and somebody just made some move, and he came out and this is so, well, it's an improv nerd show, so it's appropriate. So I was going to say it's such a nerdy thing. But he transformed the scene, like, based on the action the person was doing, but in a very smooth, savvy, quick, nobody saw it coming way. And it was kind of an astounding moment that now you would just shrug off as a cynical person who doesn't move around in improv scenes anymore. I'm talking about myself. I went up and I asked him, you know, how did you think of that at that time? And I remember Paul Grandi was in a different show that I did not think was improvised. That's how dumb I was at that time, that I did not realize that show was improvised. And it was called the Blue Velvet Lounge, and his group was called Frank Booth, and it was kind of all around the theater at I.O. and different places, and there'd be lighting, the lights would come up on somebody. That's what was cool about it. It had a technical element. And I said, that couldn't have been made up, improvised. And Grinders were like, you're an idiot.
And then at the time you were also studying with Dell.
Yes.
What was that like?
It was fruitful and very interesting. I got to do the classes for free because I was hosting a show at I.O. And so that got me classes for free. So I could take session after session after session. And that's what people would do then is, you know, there weren't seven or eight levels, but you would take the fifth level a number of times, all with Dell, if there was room. And so I got... which was good because his classes were not jam-packed with information. They're like one-third good information about improv, one-third very interesting information about his life, like stories about his life that I was fascinated with, especially because I wasn't paying for the classes. And then one-third would be him having like 15-minute coughing fits as you're improvising a Harold, and he just goes off into the bathroom, and you're you know, eight of you are on stage doing a Herald and your teacher is just so loudly coughing in the bathroom. It's echoing. And, like, do you just keep doing the scenes? And I remember, and he would bum cigarettes from people. You could smoke openly in the downstairs. I mean, this is back. I'm now an old timer. That's depressing. But this girl, he's coughing at the bar. This lovely student, she pours him a cup of water and brings it over to him. And Del's like, young lady, I need oxygen, not water. Like he basically insults her for trying to help him.
And you actually saw him kick somebody out of class.
Mm-hmm. And even before I had seen this, it's kind of funny as I tell this story because I was at the tail end of Del's teaching. I wasn't quite at the very end. You know, I was there when he was still teaching, you know, a number of classes, but this is probably 96. And so this had been happening for years, and you would hear these rumors about when Del kicks someone out of a class, it's something to behold. And you would hear about that, and I was in his class. And we in the class knew who that person would be. There was a guy who we called, this is awful me following Dana, who was so nice and like, this guy we called the Improv Apocalypse. And he was really, really bad. He just was. I'm sorry, not everyone can be great at improv or even good. If you've seen three improv shows, you know that's true. But anyway, so he was our candidate, and he's in a scene, and he does, like, classic denial. Like, give me some kind of initiation with some kind of, you know, declare me as something.
I got the dog back from the pound.
We've never had a dog. That's what the guy did. Right? And we in the class gave kind of a little, like, chuckle all amongst ourselves. It was like, ooh, I've been taking improv classes for 8 months, and I know that's a big mistake. And so we're kind of guffawing, and the scene finishes up, and Del's giving the notes, and he's, that was a horrible denial that you did in there. And the kid says back to him, he goes, yeah, but it got a laugh. Right, and there was that air sucked out of the room.
Like someone's going to get killed.
Someone's going
to get killed.
Like the baseball bat scene in, is it Goodfellas? Not Goodfellas.
Warriors.
No, not Warriors, the mob movie. Untouchables, the baseball bat. So you know, he's about to get the equivalent of his head smashed.
There's death in the air.
Yeah, and it's like, and then there's a little bit of excitement, too, right. Of like, we're going to see this.
And gratitude, yes. Like, it's not going to be me.
Right, right. Yes. It's like you've seen the lion track the zebra, and he's got it cornered, and you're like, wow, this is, you hear about this, but now you see the blood. And he goes, you can go upstairs, and the woman will give you your money back. You won't be needing to take this class anymore. And that's it. And there's just like, and the kid's like, and he probably knew the stories, too. He just didn't know it would be him. And he just kind of slinks out of the class, and that's the last of I ever saw of Timothy McVeigh. I'm kidding about that last part.
Okay. Also at that time, you're hosting the Improv Jam.
Yes.
Which is basically, it's an
open mic for improv games.
And they're doing improv games. It's a midnight show, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
And you say that this has been the most influential show you ever did.
I think to my persona as a improviser and things like stage presence and controlling a crowd and alienating a crowd, sometimes on purpose, sometimes on accident, winning an alienated crowd back, and sometimes doing the rest of the show not alienating. I'll tell you a drug story that has to do with the best show, one of the best shows I ever did of that. We took mushrooms before. I would not recommend ever taking mushrooms before an improv show. But I was an idiot. And so I did that, and the show was great. It was incredible. Everything was just magic. Best show it's probably a skewed memory. I can't remember anything specifically. So we thought it'd be a great idea to take acid and do a show. We did. My friend Bob Scoopian and I, and so we also decided to call it the Second City Audition Preparatory Jam. Now, I had maybe auditioned once for Second City at this point. You know, I was 23, 24 years old, years away from getting hired by Second City. Not really a realistic person to get hired by Second City. Certainly not someone to give lessons in how to get hired by Second City. So we did it kind of as a joke, and we may have forgotten it was that night as we took this acid. There were like 150 people there. It was the most packed it had ever been of eager improvisers wanting to get hired by Second City, and these two fucking schmoes are going to show them how to do it. So here, another awful idea that had we not been on drugs, we wouldn't have thought of. We say, Noah, could you talk to everybody at the top of the show? And anyone who's listening to this podcast, I would think, knows who Noah is.
Noah Gregoropoulos, sure.
Noah Gregoropoulos. And he's like, sure. I'm sure he relished the idea. So he goes up, and I remember
this. This is like midnight, right?
This is midnight, right. Packed right. with all young like and eager improvisers.
Right.
Probably more experienced improvisers than we were, certainly. Not Noah. And he comes up and he goes, God, I was going to do my Noah. It sounds just like my Dell, so I'll just do my voice. He says, as I look around this room, I've worked at Second City. I've directed for Second City. I know everyone who works at Second City. I look around this room, and I can say with 100% certainty, not one person in this room will be hired by Second City. and then he brings me out, tripping like an idiot, and that was the worst show that we ever did.
So and then you audition for Boom Chicago, and you get in,
uh-huh.
right? When you get offered the job, you don't want to take it. And yeah. Susan Messing, who you're living with,
yep.
and eventually married
yep.
at that time.
Yep, all kinds of stuff.
What does she tell you to convince you to take the job?
So, this is ridiculous on my part. Boom Chicago, great. Oh, if you can ever audition for Boom Chicago, do it. Or just go there and hang around for a while, and maybe they'll just make you part of the cast. Pretend you're Dutch. And you might get in, and they'll be like, boy, this Dutch person speaks perfect English and is a decent improviser. So I got hired by them. I auditioned, and of course, I thought throughout the audition process that I would never take the job. So I crushed the auditions, because who gives a shit? I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to take this job. So I killed the auditions, got offered the job, and I was like, I got to think about it. And so at the time, I was like most 20-something improvisers. I was between waiting tables jobs perpetually. And I also smoked a ton of weed at the time. And so I was like, I don't know if I'm going to go. My cat is here. it was a good cat. It was a good cat. And Susan was like, all you do is smoke weed. You don't have any job. All you do is smoke weed and improvise, and you don't have any job. And they're offering you a job where you can smoke weed and improvise all the time. Why are you not going? And she was right. I was so dumb, and so I decided to go. It was great.
And then you said you wish you would have stayed another year. You only did 1 year at Boom Chicago?
I did 1 year at Boom Chicago. I mean, wish you would have. There's, you know, like, you know. Ultimately, who knows what should or shouldn't have
been
done.
Why did you think that you might have been
I think when we did the pre-interview, I said a similar thing about the Second City 50th anniversary show. So I have similar feelings about both of these things. And, you know, the Butthole Surfers say it's better to regret something you have done than to regret something you haven't done. But my argument to that is almost anything could be regarded as having or haven't done. So that statement doesn't really make any sense. Anyway, I'm getting off track.
Yeah,
the point
yeah.
is that, like, people who stayed for a couple years at Boom, a lot of people of those people left and got jobs in the industry a lot quicker.
Like
Ike Barinholtz and Josh Myers. Jordan Peele. He may have stayed a couple years. Seth Myers was before me. He stayed a couple years. I think he's done pretty well in the industry. And so thinking, like, staying another year may have polished me up in some ways. But then I ended up getting hired at Second City, so maybe that job got done there. Now, for the 50th anniversary show,
So you're just so people know, you are the 50th anniversary. You had done four reviews.
Done four shows on the main stage.
And the 50th anniversary comes, which would have been your fifth review.
It would have been my fifth main stage reviews, which would have been a lot, which I think they would have let me do. But four shows is quite a few. That was 3 years of doing eight shows a week. And the... it doesn't take a toll on you. Again, and it's something you immediately realize, or realize a little bit after, you should have done that job for 4 more years than you did. Now, you would have been really bitter at the time doing that job for 7 years, but looking back on it, you'd have been like, oh, what a great job. But in the moment, you never know that. So you do 4 shows, and you're like, if I do a 5th show, because you've seen people who do 5th shows, or they've been there for a little too long, and they're kind of miserable.
Yeah.
And they're not into it. And then give that job to somebody who's into it, you know. But I think I could have gotten the energy up to do that show.
And what would have been the advantage of it?
Well, in my mind, it's ever since that show, Second City's notoriety has risen quite a bit. And so people who are on the main stage now have an easier time getting representation than they did before that happened. Now, I am perfectly capable of botching getting representation, no matter how badly it wants me. But, you know, and who knows if that would have been the right thing to do. But that's just, you know, sometimes those things go through your mind. Dana has a very good, I hope you've listened to her podcast first, so all these references to it you'll get. But when she said, you know, that's not a decision, who knows, that's not a decision for her.
But your feeling is, if you would have done the 50th anniversary, you would have gotten an agent and manager.
Or a manager.
Or a manager.
But again, I may have lost that because I have a real disdain for authority figures or managers and agents.
Is that what sabotages your success, you think?
I don't know. Maybe I'm just not very good. I don't believe that, but...
I think you're, like, super talented.
Yeah, a lot of people are super talented, though.
But how do you get in your own way, do you think, besides the authority?
Well, maybe not working as hard as... And some of it, you know... And I think I've done all right, and I'm not done. Maybe I am. I'm retiring from improv right now.
But let's,
I've done all I can.
Let's just go to this, and let's psychoanalyze
sure.
this, because this will be fun.
That's fine.
So you come back from Boom Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And you go on the boats at Second City. And then they give you the job at Main Stage.
Yes.
And Robin calls you up. What's Robin's last name?
Robin Hammond.
Hammond. She was producing at the time.
But she may have had a different... She may not
okay.
have been married.
So she calls you up. And she
Givens.
Offers
her name
you.
Was Robin Givens
okay,
before
great.
It was Hammond.
Yes. Okay. Before... So she offers you the Main Stage
offers
job.
Main
and tell
stage
us
job.
What you say to Robin.
Could you arrange for me to do the ETC instead because I like their schedule better? And I was half kidding about that. I like, you know, and at the time, I believe, here's the thing, at the time, ETC was getting more per show than the main stage was, I think. So, like, they were doing less shows, but they were getting about equal pay for the week.
Now, when you look back at that, do you think that that was a dick move?
No, because ultimately she pressed me on it and she knew how to respond. She's like, "Are you fucking kidding me?" Maybe she didn't say that, but she said, "Are you kidding me?" And I'm like, "No, that's fine. I'll take the main stage job." And then it was like that. But I've taken years of being me to establish the fact that I can be me in front of an authority figure. Like, there was no surprise to her that I would be like that. You know, you have to cultivate that kind of personality for a long time to not get fired right away. Like, if you're someone who's nice all the time, and then you come out with something like that, boom, you're done. But if you're constantly pecking away a little bit, then that won't be a surprise, and it'll be expected.
No.
And also, one last thing.
Yeah.
The Second City prides itself on being the temple of satire, right? And what does satire do? It takes down authority figures. Well, what has this multi-billion-dollar business become? It's a titan of the industry. It's a giant. It's an authority figure. Second City itself is. So I think they have to understand, if they want to hire the right people, they're going to hire people who hate them just for being what they are. Do you understand?
Yes, like, I totally you know? Understand. The other thing that comes up, and it came up in the pre-interview, and it's something that you and I have in common, is
sure.
this. We don't trust people because we think they're screwing us.
Right.
When it comes to money.
Right. And all you have to base that on is evidence. And, you know, that's, I think...
Do you think, because I know for me that has gotten in my way.
Sure.
Do you think it's gotten in your way?
No, because I'll do, fuck, I do shows in L.A., you know... It's not always easy to go do a show at Second City LA in front of 5 students when you did shows at Second City Chicago and earned a living doing it in front of 300 strangers. So I do plenty of free shows and understand that that's part of the gig. And I love doing it. That's the other thing. But I don't think not wanting to work has gotten me, you know, maybe fighting for my rights has gotten me in a little bit of trouble, like getting less work because they know if you're underpaid. For example, the boats, the contract I had was great.
It's like the Second City boats. Yeah.
And it got worse and worse and worse. So by the end, people were making about the same that I made to do 10 more shows a week and do other stuff too. Like I would, if they had somebody on behalf of the actors, that wouldn't have been happening.
But you like it when, like, because you fought it for Second City with the cast, and you got the money to do.
But the way I look at it is, it's reasonable. You're looking for something reasonable, and there's a give and take. You know, like, you know, I.O. Most people do shows at I.O. They don't get paid for it, but you do get something out of it. You get good, and maybe you get that job at Second City. But at Second City, you get paid. But then you just look around, and I know that your pay is what the market will bear. But when you see, it's like the NFL and NBA. Now, those are huge industries, but they're making tons of cash. You get mad at baseball players because they make $20 million a year. Well, he's making $20 million a year, but that's only because his boss is making $2 billion a year. So it's all relative. So that's why I would fight against Second City, knowing that Steve Carell wrote a scene called Pictionary that has been performed 40,000 times as an...
And let's just not say, it's not just been on stage, in corporations and...
Corporate shows on all the boats, and it wasn't just Steve Carell who wrote it, but that's the name that people will know. I think Paul Dinello wrote it, and Ruthie Rudnick, and maybe...
Fran Adams,
okay? So there's everybody who wrote it, and none of whom got any money for it, other than their nightly fee. Second City has thrown that scene around and made millions of dollars on it. So that's not fair. So that's what, at the time, that was my big point of contention. And now they pay people to write shows.
So give me one, because I could go on forever with you.
Sure, well,
give
I could me go one on
of
forever,
your,
too.
Give me one of your favorite main stage moments.
Well, I remember an early, just the first one that comes into my mind is, like, I think the first show I did, there was, usually when you start a Second City show, you go into the previous show for a couple weeks before when the person before you leaves. And you take that spot and you do their role. And so you're doing the old show for a while before you write the new one.
Whose spot did you take?
Matt Craig.
Okay.
And let me also say, Matt Craig was very influential in me getting that job. He lobbied for me to get it. And that's how I've gotten a lot of jobs. Like, I was thinking, like, out in L.A., jobs I've gotten, opportunities, are because I knew people. So that's just a little tip. Get to know a lot of important people.
That wonderful
people.
Piece you did on Jimmy Kimmel Live, was that through a friend or you had audition?
That wasn't exactly through a friend. That was kind of through a friend. My friend Ike Barinholtz is a writer for The Mindy Project. I worked with him at Boom Chicago. He stayed for 2 years. He's a producer of The Mindy Project. I stayed for 1 year. I host an open mic 2 nights a week at Iowa West. So anyway, I did an improv show with him, and I guess Mindy Kaling was watching the show. But Ike brought me in for an audition. I got the part, and I got to do the show. Mindy Kaling was there, and so she called for me to do the thing on the Jimmy Kimmel show. So it was because of Ike. If I had fucked it up and been bad in the improv show or bad on the show, I probably wouldn't have gotten asked to do the other thing. So you can get in the door with friends, and then if you're totally awful, you just need to have better friends, and then you can keep working. But otherwise, you have to be good to keep working afterwards.
So it's your first show. Go back the moment, your Second City.
Oh, yeah. I just remember, like, it may have been the very first night I went in. There's this improv thing where, hey, we'll take your information, and then we'll turn it into a song, and you'll be amazed, and you won't know how easy it was. And so I come out, and there's some basketball thing. I take a basketball out, and Molly Erdman, who now is my wife, at the time was actually married to someone else. I flung the ball, like, real hard at her. And I knew Molly, and I've known her for years. But I just came out and, like, did, like, I was probably very excited, so I did, like, a basketball chest pass with a basketball, but, like, at a distance of maybe 7 feet to a woman who certainly wasn't expecting that hard of a basketball pass. And it kind of hit her in the stomach, and she, like, looked at me with this, like, what are you doing? You effing idiot, someday we'll be married. That was not the look in her face. And that was just the first memory that came to mind. Every memory from the Second City main stage is my favorite memory of it. Every single minute, arguments, laughs.
I can
all
imagine
of it.
You could get into some good arguments.
I'm a great arguer.
I think you love that, don't you?
Yes.
What is it about that you love?
The competitive element of it, and just it harkens back to that like teasing reaction attention thing. Maybe like if you're engaged in an argument, I've got your full attention.
Did people ever get hurt by you? Like you
physically?
No. Like
Liz Kikowski did chip my tooth at Boom Chicago, but
we were pissed off at you.
Yeah, I'm sure a couple times. Now the problem with me, I'll get, and this is maybe a family thing. I've an Italian father, Irish mother. Yelling was not a big deal. There can be yelling in my house, and then we're watching the Yankee game, and it's done.
Right.
I'm fine with that. I can get in a yelling, screaming match with you, and then do whatever afterwards. Not everyone is like that. So when there'd be arguments, I probably said a few things in the heat of the moment. Not things that weren't true, but things that I could have said in a different way. Not too much. I think ultimately you might think I'm a hard person to work with on the outside, but I would bet nearly everyone, and maybe everyone that I've worked with, would want to work with me again in a group setting like that. I think you need somebody to be kind of a jerk in a way. Hopefully a lovable jerk.
Why do you need a jerk?
Well, because so shit doesn't go unchecked. Like if no one, that politeness and telling the truth are like, sometimes they're at odds. Like something can go unchecked for a long time. This goes all the way up to like NSA snooping and everything. If something goes unchecked, like I feel like Edward Snowden is looked at as a traitor much more than he's looked at as a hero. But if you look at what he exposed, he should be a hero if you examine what he's telling everybody happened. But I think we accept that. It goes unchecked. Yeah, they're checking your phone records. Yeah, they're doing this. Yeah, they're doing that. Now, in terms of underpaying you in an improv show, it's a totally different level of stakes. But if somebody's kind of being selfish in a group, and this is in a sketch show, if someone is kind of getting away with shit, yes, always.
What would you say to them?
I'd be like, come on. Like, if someone's bitching about something that doesn't need to be bitched about, be like, come on, nobody cares. And if it's something that's legit, I'm willing to debate the merits of your argument, but and who am I to say what goes? I am because I'm saying it. Like, the squeaky wheel also, there's something to that also. All right. I know I'm all over the place with this, but I have a rhyme to the reason.
Okay. So let's improvise.
Great.
I'm a little intimidated. I have a lot of respect for you, so I'm a little like, I want to do really well.
I'm a very IO improviser.
What is?
I think that means I'm a good improviser ultimately. But there's different types of improv where people. I think we speak the same language.
Okay, great.
But I do have a question. Is this a video podcast or an audio?
It's
podcast?
A video podcast.
It is. Okay.
No, it's audio and video. So what we do is this is the
because if it's just audio, I'm saying let's not get out of these chairs.
I mean, we could still do that if you want. It's up to you since you're the guest.
I mean, we could be really pretentious and turn the lights out and do a bat.
We did that with Rachel.
Of course you did. Forget it. Fine. Let's just do it. Let's just do the scene then.
Okay, great.
Of course. We could be like TJ and Dave and not take a suggestion and ask the audience to trust us. It's all made up. Despite the fact that everybody fucking knows it's made up. Nobody's like, oh, it's not made up?
Well, so why do you think we still take suggestions?
Well, to serve the audience and let them think they're contributing in some way. I often would say, like Weezalicious, which is a group that I cherish and love playing with, we kind of would take a similar tack to TJ and Dave in a different way, which is to say we would come out and say, could we please have a suggestion to ignore? And then we might just use it right away or we might never use it. But ultimately, if you do a funny show for the audience, who cares what the fucking suggestion was? Who cares if you made it up without a suggestion? Like, we were on purposely pretentious with the suggestion taking.
So,
not to say that TJ and Dave are being pretentious with their suggestion taking, but they are kind of icons of the industry, and they get a lot of respect, which is well-deserved. But as we've discussed earlier, I have a tendency to take shots at authority figures. So I might say that it's pretentious to say, trust us, this is all made up. But I know neither of them listen to this podcast.
Okay. So we don't even want to take a suggestion? Is that?
No, I'm fine taking a suggestion.
Okay, great.
I don't care.
Okay, so
That's what I'm saying. I don't give a shit.
Well, why didn't you just say that? Why didn't you just say that?
Because I think the other stuff needs to be said, too.
Okay, I'm glad you said it, then. Okay, great. Could we have a suggestion, please?
Podcast
is a suggestion. Now, you want to sit in the...
Let's improvise.
Okay, great. Okay. So when you hear a podcast, what do you do? You're just going to throw it out? Or do you actually use the suggestion?
I'll take... it's going to give me one idea, and then that's it. It's done.
Okay. And you want to tell us what the idea is, or would you rather show it?
You know what? It's easier to just say it, because then everyone will know what the situation is, and I can improvise more lazily and not have to explain it. Plus, it's an audio podcast.
Right, yes.
And my object work is sketchy.
Okay.
So when what was the suggestion?
Podcast.
Great. I thought Guitar Center. Going to be in the audio section of Guitar Center. I'm going to be a dude. I'm not sure if I'm working at the Guitar Center or if I'm browsing at the Guitar Center.
Do you do any sort of character? Or are you just going to play?
Kind of a snarky East Coast guy with glasses most of the time.
Okay.
I said earlier I'm an IO improviser, right?
Yeah. So what do you mean about that in terms of character?
I think generally speaking, IO is a more... You could write the script of a good I.O. scene. You could transcribe it and give it to somebody, and they could just play the lines, and it would still be funny. Now, they could choose to be characters with it, but I think the content of the words is generally funny, whether it be the situation or whatever happens. Whereas I think in other modes of improvisation, if you have a very specific character, what they say does not even matter as much. Even whether it makes sense or not does not matter. Like, think of the Mango character. Not maybe the most constructed character.
For people that don't remember, it was Chris
Saturday Night Live. Yes. And I'm sure the Groundlings are like, please don't point that out as our most typical character, because it certainly isn't.
He was like a monkey, wasn't he?
Right. He's a monkey man.
Right.
Like 15 times.
Right.
He was a monkey man 15 times, and there's very little arc. But it's a big, broad character that you laugh at right away. Then it's up to you to keep it going throughout that. Whereas in the Chicago IO style, I think, again, you build it slowly. TJ and Dave probably would be a great example of this. If you were to transcribe, and they do, they don't they? Haven't someone done that yet? Transcribe the show and then, you know, sell it online?
I don't know. I know they've done a documentary where they've shot a show, but I don't know. Yeah.
Like, it's as good as most scripted comedy. Mm-hmm. So I think IO, and when it's done well, can be like that. Whereas I think other stuff, if you were to read the script of it and not know what the character was, you'd be like, this is shit.
All right, so let's improvise.
Great.
Okay, great. Mickey, man, look at what I got. Bass.
Bruce.
What?
You're working. You're on the clock. You can't...
I know, man, but you came in here.
I came in here because I'm checking the stock.
Okay, man.
You got to be out on the floor. Is this space for a customer?
No, it's for the band, man. What?
The band is after hours. You can tell people about your band. You can pick up the bass. You can play it in front of them and demonstrate the bass. But you can't be thinking about the band when we're working, all right?
But man, how are we going to get ahead if we don't?
We're going to rehearse and practice and get good with our instruments and write some great hooks and... No.
What, man? No one's here.
Closer to the door. Okay. Closer to the outside.
But no, you can't. I can't
touch it. I can't touch it.
What, man?
I can't touch it.
Okay.
I didn't say anything. Okay. I can't touch it.
Okay.
Oh, we'll crack the door a little more.
Okay, man.
All right, put it out. Put it out. One's enough.
Okay, I'm putting it out.
Okay, stop.
Okay.
All right, you got to bring the bass back out there. But there's nothing left of that, man.
Okay.
There's nothing left of it. Oh. Yeah. All right.
That's good, man.
Here, have a take that.
Thanks.
Don't pull your hand away when I'm doing that. I was still pouring them out.
Okay.
Wait, you want a Tic Tac?
Yeah, I'm on a diet.
A diet?
Yeah, those things have got like 16 calories.
No, it's like, isn't that half a calorie? Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
16 in that little thing?
Yeah.
I ate like 3 or 4 of these packs a day.
I want to be in shape, man, for the band. You know what I'm saying?
No. You're the bass player.
What do you mean? Come on. I'm going to be up there behind you, like.
Yeah, with your big bass hiding your stomach. Don't worry about it. You're the bass player. Look, look. Hey.
Oh, man.
Oh, come on.
No, man. Now I feel like such a loser.
You're the lead guitarist, man, the lead vocal, and I'm just this fat guy with the bass in front of my stomach?
Yeah, I play keyboards, too, sometimes. Don't forget.
Look, man.
Oh, come on.
This sucks, man.
You remember, you saw the James Brown movie.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it was James Brown and the Famous Flames. It wasn't the Famous Flames.
Oh, man, this sucks, man.
No!
What were you going to tell me, man?
What was I going to tell you? You were the bass player?
Well, I knew that, but I mean, I thought we were like a partnership, like, hell, what is that? Had Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
They did not get along at all. Famous.
What about Hall & Oates, man?
That's we're not aspiring to that. We want to be better than that.
Okay, man.
We're still, I was just talking about the, you know.
But I wanted to get chicks and stuff, man. That's what you told me.
Yeah, you're still going to get chicks. You're going to get, you know, it's the line. I'll get like one, maybe three chicks at the most, and then the rest are for
I'm going to get your scraps, man?
But I mean, like, you know, there's plenty. It's not scraps. It's all 90% lean. Is that?
No, man.
I'm a vegetarian. I don't know the terms.
Man, this is bullshit, man. I'm pissed, man. I'm totally pissed, man. You do this to me all the time.
There's no one on the floor right now.
I don't give a shit, man. The band is breaking up. That's what's important.
Yes, it is, man.
I'm breaking it up, man.
Fuck.
Why don't you do this to me?
Wait, are you saying you're leaving the band?
Yes, is what I'm saying, man.
That's totally different than misconstruing that I'm breaking up the band. Okay, you are.
Oh, good, man. You got to cover your ass all the time, man.
I'm just saying.
It's not gonna be you. It's gonna be me. They're all gonna blame it on me.
But
you're gonna have to tell Nate, man.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You really can't break up the band. Ringo couldn't break up the Beatles.
You are a fucker.
No,
you are a total fucker, man. You fucking always do this to me when I am down. Fucking kick me right in the nutsack.
I'm just trying to give you a dose here of reality.
So what were you doing, man? You were just like,
I was checking the
inventory. No, man. You were just like going, okay, he's just let him ride our coattails.
No! Ringo's he's still alive. I mean, he's
don't try to get out of this, man. You're gonna try to talk your way out of it.
Maybe you're Paul. He played the bass. You're not. let's finish the shift. Let's get out there. We'll talk about the band. We'll get the other members involved. Or we never have to talk about this again, okay?
Okay. I want to do the first song. I want to do the first song, and I'll stay.
You want to, like,
sing it and play it on bass.
Well, definitely can do the second part.
No, man. I want to sing, man. I've been in this band for like 4 years now. I drive you guys everywhere because I have a van. We work in my mom's basement.
Yeah.
Okay?
And it's your mom's van, to be fair. I mean, she doesn't.
Okay, fine, man. I want to sing a song.
The first song?
I want to sing the first song.
Okay.
I want to talk about, I wrote a song about breaking up with Sheila.
Sheila?
Yeah.
That's the girl you were before the band even started, you broke up with her.
Right. I've been writing this song for about 4 years. I was waiting for my opportunity.
You could have brought the song up after 2 years.
No, I couldn't, because every time you said, go just play the bass. Go play the bass.
All right.
Bass players don't sing.
I didn't mean to squelch your dream. I didn't know that you even aspired to write songs. 4 years.
Well, you know what?
Have you written any others in that time, or just the one?
Just one.
Wow.
I want to see how it goes over. like a focus group.
Well, I mean, I can afford you one song every 4 years. There's no threat in that. All right. Well, we'll listen to it. We'll do it the first thing rehearsal tonight. All
right. But we're going to do it in the show on Saturday at the Vic.
That's a big show for us.
I understand.
I understand. We're just gonna try this song about Sheila. I'm gonna come right out there. You know what, too? What? I got some dry ice. I want some dry ice.
You right now have some dry ice?
Yeah, I have it in my car.
Well, in a few days, there won't be any dry ice. We'll get some more dry ice.
Okay.
What's been going on? All right, yeah, all right, fine. We'll do the song. We'll listen to it today. Maybe we'll open with the song.
And you're not going to back out. It's a deal, right? We're going to shake on it.
It's a deal. It's a deal.
Look in my eyes.
Yeah, I can barely see your eyes. You're so high.
Okay.
Are my eyes good?
Yeah, I don't know if we... I don't think we should go back on the floor.
We're too high, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, we should just stay back here, I guess.
I love you, man.
I love you, too, man.
I'm glad we could talk this out, man. Pump this out.
I'm glad the band is still intact.
Yeah.
And you're not Ringo, man. Jerry's Ringo.
I know Jerry. He's totally
Ringo.
I thought at the beginning we were a little slow to find it.
Yeah, and I had a moment when I... Because we had talked about... You know, we had... So rare.
Right.
In fact, first time ever, I think I've... taken the suggestion, deconstructed it, and then started the scene.
Did that throw you off?
No, but I still made the same choice because I said I wanted to be lazy, so I didn't change it. And then when you were talking about the band, for a moment I thought, oh, shit, the lines dictate that we could be in a garage or something,
right.
But I'm still playing the Guitar Center game.
Right.
But being a savvy improviser, we turned it around.
Now, did you think, because you were lazy, that we were going to... I was going to play high status and you were going to play low status?
No, I play low status sometimes, but I'd say my go-to is high status.
Okay.
And some of that is who you play with and stuff, but I think my tendency is to go high status. And I did not consider at all what you would do.
Right.
Which is a little annoyancy. And it's
in terms of what?
Well, you know, take care of yourself first, and then trust that the other person. And that's something that I believe. I was thinking about improv in preparation for this. I hope so, and I'm not just randomly thinking about it all the time, but maybe I am. So I was thinking about how the people I improvise with I've known for years, mm-hmm. and that's part of what makes me a good improviser is I'm able to 100% trust everyone I improvise with and know, like, I only improvise with really funny people. So it's like a 99% going to be funny just on me knowing them. And having that confidence in them makes me a confident, easygoing improviser, which makes you at ease and makes most of the scenes be good. And I would hope the other people I improvise with think the same thing.
So was it hard? Was there a trust thing? Like, oh, I haven't played with Jimmy in a while?
No, because again, I think, you know, I've seen you improvise for years, and I know, generally speaking, where you are mm-hmm. as an improviser, which is, I think we speak the same language. So, again, I do my thing, figure out, and then, did you have the first line?
Yeah,
I think that's
so.
Also a tendency I do, where I'll make my status choice, and or I'll hear your line, because by hearing your line first... It allows me to place myself in reference to your line.
Explain that.
So whatever your first line is, let's say I come out and I'm thinking I'm a high status guy. So whatever your first line is, I can hear that line. I can then incorporate your information and use your information to put myself in whatever position I want to be. Let's say it's a high status position because that's my tendency. So you come in and say, got to get the band together or whatever. I, in my mind, thought I was the manager at the store. So then I say, what do you got the instrument for? I've already put you in a position of you're kind of the doofus.
Right, I'm the dumb fuck up in the scene.
Yeah, and not that you're, and your initiation, at least to me, suggested that was a possibility.
Yeah.
You know? I've just, that's it. Your line came. I had a preconditioned thought in my character, and so using that character, I responded to your information. The one That's thing, way more thought than I gave it at the time.
Right. The one thing I thought was, like, we both got high, but we weren't really... I wasn't affected by it.
No. Well, I'm, you know...
It would. I think it would have added something.
Being affected by it?
Yeah.
Well, I think that if you smoke pot enough, people won't know you're affected by it even when you're high.
Do you still smoke a lot of pot?
It's ironic that you would say something like that after what I just said. I think, yeah, sure. I have a prescription, though, so I'm taking medicine.
You're not high now, right?
I don't know.
Are you serious? Okay. What do you say to people that get high before a show?
It depends on the show. I might say, give me some.
Okay.
But when I worked in Amsterdam, I got high one time the day of a show. But that Amsterdam stuff is knock you out. So I didn't do that ever before shows. And I never did that before Second City shows. Scripted shows is a different thing.
Because?
Because you have to hit the marks and you have to hit the lines and there's other things depending on you. And maybe there's, you know, there's stage crosses and dark lights and...
You could get hurt.
You could get hurt, yeah. And you're getting paid, perhaps.
Right.
So.
Great. So we're going to take some questions from the audience. If we could turn the lights up, Sam, that would be great. A question for what we just did or for Joe. Yes, right here.
Yeah. You play out in Iowa West, too. Is there a difference between out there and in Chicago?
There are many differences. The audiences are bigger here. There are more non-improvisers, I think, here who just come out to see shows. Like, improvisation is more a thing to do for an evening out here, whereas almost all performance in L.A. is there anyone to see here? And I think, you know, both... There are a lot of industry people who hopefully are thinking that, but I think that's just kind of that's the function of improv shows in California. And various theaters do a better job of being that and drawing people and stuff like that.
Great. Another question? Yeah, right here. Lauren?
I was just wondering how important you think it is to make fun of institutions for comedy.
Well, it depends on what kind of comedy that you do. Like, for a cynical, sarcastic person like me, Second City, that person, my friend Russ, who suggested years ago that I take classes at Second City, was spot on, I think, in his assessment. I feel like I am a prototype person to have worked at that place. And maybe that's me laying on my thoughts, but I'm a white guy, so that's the number one thing at Second City over the history of the place. It's changed drastically in the last 10 years, for the better. But that's kind of the standard thing. And then someone who is a bit of a, you know, sarcastic shot taker, I think that has existed there for a long time, if you look at their catalog. So I think for that kind of comedy, for satire, it's almost the definition of it. For what makes me funny, I think it's pretty necessary, too. But that's just me and who I am. You know, like, I don't think Chris Farley, though he worked at Second City, was great there. I don't know that his forte was actually political satire or social satire. Although maybe it was, depending on how deeply you look at it. But he was, you know, he had a different style, equally good.
Great. Question over here. Yes.
Sure.
I thought you had your
hand up. He did not have his hand up, but when pressed,
but
he will
listening,
fabricate it.
And he was listening so intently.
I can rebound off of hers, actually. Have you had any, like, relationships that you felt have been hurt because of your cynical personality? Or, like, have you, yeah.
Maybe.
Self-destructive?
Maybe. I tend to take jokes pretty well. And I think, again, same thing, like talking about being a lightning rod. And I think if you're someone who's constantly peppering insults around, you expect and maybe even hope for a little bit to come back. Like, and there's a function to that, too, of being the person who people can kind of take their aggression out on, in a way. So with peers, I don't know that I've suffered that much. Maybe with some authorities... above, but never in a way that ultimately, I think, restricted me from doing anything I wanted to do. you know.
Was the you were married with Susan, and then you got divorced. How did that, and you were at IO at the time and working up the ladder at Second City, how did that divorce affect you?
Well, I mean, has anyone, anybody here divorced? Not yet? Okay. statistics say many of you will not have that answer in 10 years. But it's always an unpleasant situation, regardless of the circumstances. When you were married to an icon in her field, that
also...
And
you're much younger than her at the time, right?
Still am.
Okay.
Yes. I've always been younger than her, in fact. But and less established by virtue of that. So I think, you know, and there's, you know, there are people, there's sides taken, and, you know, people are allied with one or the other, and there's stories, and, you know. So I think the whole community, in a way, especially more Susan than me, but I was established in the community. Everyone knows who I am. So something like that is kind of beyond the... like gossipy type thing. It affects many, many personal relationships that people have, professional and personal. And I will say, like Sharna, for example, who has been friends with Susan for a long time, and there was no favoritism. She didn't take any sides or anything like that, and she was always great throughout that process, you know. And it may have kind of, you know, restarted me or whatever in terms of like my position in the community. I don't know that it ultimately really affected things in a bad way, but other than the rift that it causes in the community, I mean, we can joke about divorce and everything, but it's rarely fun. It's not like it's a fun thing. But I will say, Susan and I, Susan is a great, great ex-wife. I think I'm a pretty good ex-husband. Like, I think that we are good exes, which is in some ways, you know, marriages come and go, but divorce is forever. So you really got to nurture that relationship because you don't go anywhere from there unless you're a friend of ours who married the same person twice. And
who's that?
Well, I don't want to say her name, but okay. She's someone you know who's an improviser.
Okay.
Who was married to the same person twice.
Okay.
I'll tell you who it was afterwards.
Thank you. Now you're in L.A. You've been there for 5 years.
Yes.
And you're taking classes at the Groundlings.
Yes.
Now, how is that different from training here in Chicago? And you're starting like...
Right. Starting around, you know. I auditioned to take an improv class at the Groundlings. And I did my scene with an English as a second language woman. So that was very exciting for me to have improvised for 20 years and not be sure if you're going to pass the intro to improv audition. I did pass. I passed it. But I took classes there. Now, I'm more interested in taking their sketch writing classes and if it works out in doing a Sunday company type thing or, you know, whatever comes after that at Groundlings. I wasn't taking improv classes to become a better improviser. Because I feel like you top out at 20 years. Like, Michael Jordan wasn't a better player his last 3 years of his career. You know, he was as good as he was going to get at a certain point. It's a different thing.
So what is it like for you to be in those classes?
It was, in some ways, it was very interesting because they have a totally different approach.
What is their approach?
It's much more character-based and make an immediate choice physically and everything all at once. It's very everything all at once, much the antithesis of Chicago-style improv. And like I said, I consider myself a child of this city and style. So that was everything I don't usually do. Now, sometimes I would, but it's breaking like all the habits and everything that I had. And yet at the same time, the improv, most people were starters, so it's very rudimentary in that way. Like, I can hold a scene together for a fucking hour just from being able to improvise long form and stuff, but nothing there really went that long. So the skills that I possess were not necessarily used to their best advantage there. There were different skills that I had developed there.
So how was that like, okay, I got to take this class. I got to take these classes because I got to sketch write, and then I'm really just doing sketch write so I get do the Sunday show so I get an agent or a manager.
Right. And I think that's it. And I think that's one of the differences between Los Angeles and Chicago. I think in Chicago, and you can make all kinds of different parallels between stand-up and improv and this and that, but I think in Chicago, you come here because you want to be good at something and you learn to do it, and you may aspire to Second City or something, and you get to do some form of that or whatever, but you're spending your time in a lower pressure, not need to succeed way. In Los Angeles, there are still people who start there, but they're also trying to get an agent and get out and meet managers and do all that stuff at the same time. So I think there is, again, a pressure for product out there. And I'm not the first person to say this. It's probably pretty common. Product over process, which Chicago, I think, embraces the process a little bit more. And like, if you were to... I think someone from the Groundlings is very good. Like, let's take SNL as a great example. I think, and this may be a stereotype, but Groundlings performers are cut out for that show. They can do impressions, they can do characters, they can take a script that isn't, like, super strong and was hastily written, and with a strong character, they can make that thing very good. I think the stereotype, and correctly so, of Chicago improv and sketch is that, you know, you can get more writers out of it because the content, you can look at it on the page and it's funny, and you don't need to see the character doing it. Those are broad strokes, and there are many exceptions to both. But I think that's kind of the generalization, I would say, of that versus...
We've got to wrap this up. Two quick questions. One is, you said you would never tell anyone to be a great improviser versus a stand-up.
Well, and I was thinking about that when I was watching the previous show. What I would say is, I love doing improv shows. I would, if I had the time and the place and a guarantee of a decent audience, I would do an improv show every night. But, you know, I would advise you to do improv all the time and then develop a more marketable skill at the same time, whether it be stand-up or just sketch writing or script writing, you know, writing TV scripts or all that. I think it plays in with one another, and I think, like, when I write things, I use improvisational skills to do that, and when I do stand-up, I am very improvisational. But those are quicker roads to jobs than just doing improv. In L.A., I think things have changed, again, since that Second City 50th anniversary. Chicago's become a much better, bigger city, of course, after I leave, for getting work professionally in the industry in the past few years. So it maybe can happen with improv shows.
What one piece of advice would you give someone starting out today?
In improv?
Yep.
Work on another skill as well as improv. What I just said is exactly what I would say. Take improv, never stop doing improv, keep doing improv, because... Improv is great, and it builds, it lets you learn how to work with other people. That's a thing that not everybody who does stand-up certainly is good at. I see a lot of stand-ups. I said I host an open mic. If you are antisocial and hate people, then go right to stand-up, because that's a lot of stand-ups. Great stand-ups can do both, you know, but improv builds the skills of working with other people and not being precious about your stuff, but... writing and doing stand-up will get you representation and work much quicker.
Joe Canelli, thank you so much for being our guest.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. Can you believe it? It's episode 131, better known as the Joe Canelli episode. And I just love that guy. I love talking to him, and I love working with him. And I love when he was talking about leaving places like Boom Chicago and Second City too soon. And he was... really honest, and you cannot criticize someone who's that honest. Also, I want to thank the good people here at Stage 773. These are the people that treat us like rock stars. I love these guys. Also, my producer here in Chicago, Dan Schiffmacher, he's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. Without him, you wouldn't be hearing my voice. Also, if you want to know more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes, The Art of Slow Comedy, and my Improv Nerd blog, which each week... I write a new blog that will make you a better improviser and a better person. Go to my website, jimmycorain.com, and sign up for the newsletter so I can send it directly. So you can be one of the first people to get that blog each week. Also, you know, we're taking over social media, and we're doing it slowly. First, we did it with Facebook. You can go to our Improv Nerd fan page and like us, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Then follow us over at Improv_Nerd. And then we have a wonderful YouTube channel. We have clips from the actual shows that we tape, which are really fun to watch. We're lucky enough to be included in Feral Audio. FeralAudio.com is some of the most innovative and unique podcasts out there. There's people like, are you ready for some name dropping? Chelsea Peretti, Todd Barry, Dan Harmon, Steve Agee, Matt Dwyer. The list goes on and on. Let's throw Jimmy Corrine in there just for fun. Can you name drop yourself? I guess, because I just did. Also, I want to thank you for listening, because without you, well, this would just be, it'll just be a hobby. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Patocki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm
a bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a
rich. I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat.
I help people.
She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My